Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Every episode takes a bare minimum of 30 hours, sometimes up to 60, 70.
Wow.
Because I'm a one-man band. I shoot it myself. I edit it myself. I color correct. I do the voiceover all in my apartment, just me.
That's insane, dude. Today, we welcome Andrew Ray, the man who makes fun, engaging, and downright informative, mostly hands-only, short-form food videos. His first series, Binging with Babich, has over a million subscribers. Am I right? It's like...
just hit 1.5.
1.5. So it's like, it's if you rounded it, it'd be 2 million.
That's the way I like to think about it. And really, it's almost 3 million at
exactly.
That point.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's YouTube subscribers. That's big time. Here to talk about binging, his new series, Basics, and his new book, Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers, is the inimitable Andrew Ray. Welcome to Special Sauce, Andrew.
Ed, thank you very much for having me.
But I did notice that's why I put in mostly hands only, because if you look at every episode of Binging with Babich, I can see your handsome mug.
Oh, Ed. Yeah, no, I try to keep it out of there as much as possible, but it wasn't to try and be anonymous. It was to try and keep the focus on the food rather than the person, because I feel like there's too many cooking shows on YouTube that are more personality than cooking.
Yes,
so
I wanted to make
the opposite of that.
Well, we're going to get to YouTube and personalities and all that stuff. I have a lot to talk to you about.
I'm jumping in too fast. Sorry.
That's all right, man. So first of all, tell us about life at the Ray family table growing up.
Oh, well, my mom taught me to cook when I was very young, taught me to bake more accurately. It was, I think the earliest thing I remember baking was the chocolate chip cookies that you saw in the back of the Nestle Toll House bag.
Yeah.
That unchanged to this day. Another favorite snack, this isn't really cooking, but she used to take big bowls of snow when it was snowing outside and pour maple syrup over it.
Wow, like shaved ice.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a rustic shaved ice. And,
an artisanal shaved ice. Your mother invented artisanal shaved ice.
Way before its time.
Way before its time.
Yeah, this was back in the 90s. Nothing was artisanal back then. And she passed away when I was young, when I was 11. And it's cooking is a way to sort of be closer to her and remember her. And so that's why maybe a large reason why it's been an important part of my day-to-day.
And was she a good cook?
Yeah, she was a great cook.
And what did she cook?
She made lots of stews. Again, one of my favorite things to make. I love, you know, just seeing a tough cut of meat turn into something tender and delicious over time. And what else did she make? She made
lasagna.
Oh, of course, lasagna.
Mothers all make
Parmesan.
Lasagnas, no matter what ethnic group they belong to.
Yeah, she was mostly Italian. So we had lots of that. We had lots of chicken parm and chicken French, which people tell me is a Rochesterian invention.
Wait, so you grew up in Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
And what the hell is chicken French?
It's essentially just lemon chicken. It's chicken that's been hit with flour, sauteed, lemon juice. And everybody says it's invented in Rochester, which just cannot be true.
No, I think it was invented somewhere in Italy or France.
Yeah.
And so did you gravitate to helping her at an early age?
Yeah, no, I loved helping out in the kitchen. I loved, you know, eating the cookie dough, obviously. I helped out as much as I could. I was really only good at making grilled cheese and ramen, though, the packet ramen. That was all I had a grasp on for a long time.
But you never thought that you would make a living from food at that point?
No, definitely not. I always wanted to go to culinary school, and I had to choose between culinary or film. So at the end of high school,
which makes sense given what the subject matter of Binging with Babich is, which is food and film.
Exactly. I was very lucky to find an intersection of my two favorite things. So almost like a flip of a coin, practically, I chose film school. My dad is a photographer, though, so that would played an influence. And just sort of kept cooking alive as an adamant hobby.
Mm-hmm. As a passion.
Passion, yes.
Yeah. So you went to film school, and then you came to New York to find your fame and fortune as an editor or as a producer?
Yes. I sold my car and moved here, you know, just car, first couple months rent. And My first job was at the Chocolate Room in Brooklyn, which I don't know if you've ever been
I remember there. The Chocolate Room.
Yeah, it's a little chocolate bar. I think there's still one left.
Yeah, there's one left. There were two, right, at one point?
Yeah, yeah. And the one that I was working at closed, and I was a plater. So I just made the desserts look pretty. I rolled quenelles of whipped cream. And
you were a plater.
And I torched the creme brulees and all that stuff.
You could call yourself a line cook there. Nobody would know the difference.
They were insistent on calling me a plater, so I don't know if I've earned that.
Well, how did you get your first job doing what you were doing in the film business for a long time?
I interned like crazy. And if there are any film students or any students listening, I wholeheartedly encourage you to intern your ass off as much as you can when you're in school, because I didn't do it when I was in school and I had to do it for a year and a half after graduating before I finally found a paying
job. And you weren't
job.
Being paid?
No. It was an unpaid internship in a visual effects post-production house called Point 360, which is now gone. I just leave a trail of destruction in my wake, I guess. Everything
this
slows.
This could be a recurring theme in your career. I don't know what's going on here.
I feel bad all of a sudden. So I interned there for about a year and a half. I kept lobbying to try and get hired there. Eventually, they started paying me $10 an hour. And then finally, I was also working a bunch of other odd jobs. I worked at Anthropology. I was loss prevention, which is that guy at the door that goes through your
purse.
You
were a security guard, loss prevention. You were a security guard.
I wish I was a security guard. Maybe I would have had a uniform. I'm not like a big, intimidating dude. I was just – if you set off the alarm when you're leaving the store, I had to go through your purse, which is like – so horrible. Everybody hates you. Just all day, you're just being hated.
And then you finally – they did finally offer you a job.
Yeah. No. I got a job at a place called Switch FX, which is a very small boutique visual effects house that I stayed at for 7 years.
Wow.
And I'm still dear, dear friends to this day. They have an acknowledgement in my book. And I literally just came from those offices just now. I've swung by there to visit. I'm actually going to go back so I can get some work done in their offices before dinner tonight.
And what is a visual effects supervisor like? What do you do?
Well, all the things that you're never supposed to notice. I was working all in commercials, and it would be things like if an actor was wearing a Nike shirt, I would have to get rid of the logo. If you know they wanted to change the screen on a cell phone, I would need to track in a new screen, you know, rotoscope, cut out their thumbs one frame at a time, just all the things that you're supposed to not notice when you actually watch the commercial.
You're supposed to make everything invisible.
Yes, that's yes. Like blemishes as well, you know, lighten up people's eyes under the bags under their eyes. If their eyes are too red, if they look stoned, gotta sober them up, stuff like that.
And all that time, were you indulging your passion for food in any way?
Absolutely. I always called myself a psycho hobbyist because I would decide, you know, on a Thursday, I want to make the best meatballs in the world tonight. I'm going to read Kenji's recipe.
That's right. You're a huge Kenji. I mean, Kenji was a real influence, right?
I'm what is referred to on Reddit, I think, as a Kenji disciple. I am one of his flock. Yes, I religiously read every article he came out with, and I would say that he's been
so
one
Kenji
of my biggest
Lopez
instructors.
Also is, of course, the managing culinary director for Serious Eats and the author of Food Lab and someone that Andrew and I. That's how we came together.
Yeah, absolutely. He reached out to you, right?
Yeah,
because he
exactly.
and I were talking on Reddit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met him very, very briefly once because I did a little bit of freelance video work for you guys.
Yes, that's
years
right.
Ago.
As an intern,
yeah.
Or maybe as a production assistant, I can't remember.
I think it was just like a one-time thing. I just loved you guys so much, and I just kept emailing like, "Can I please do something?" And I went to what's it called
Dave Arnold's.
Yeah, Dave
bar.
Arnold's place. Yeah. That's it. And yeah, I watched. I got some B-roll of them making cocktails, and
that was your contribution to Serious Eats.
Yes, I'm happy to have done something at some point.
So you were learning on your own, basically. You were teaching yourself to some of the more craft-oriented aspects of cooking.
Yes. I have not gone to culinary school. I feel like I should. Being so exposed now, I should really get my knife technique down.
Yeah, like if you're 1.5 million subscribers, man, you really got to get your knife skills down.
I think I got him in a good place okay. where I'm not going to hack off any fingers
okay.
anymore.
That's progress.
Doing the claw, and I'm, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I got it down.
All right. What form did that hobby, that psycho hobby, take? Throwing dinner parties?
Yeah, throwing dinner parties, making my poor significant other wait until, midnight to have dinner because I decided, you know, tonight I'm making the craziest chicken parmesan or whatever. And, just spending all my free time just trying new things, trying Kenji's recipes, making amalgams of all my favorite recipes, taking this part that I like, and making it my own. And I'm happy to have found an outlet for it because it was getting unhealthy, I think.
But at what point did you think maybe I should create something out of my love of food and my knowledge of film?
It was very much on accident.
It's like all great creative things.
Exactly, yeah. Like rubber. Rubber was invented entirely by accident.
Right.
Maybe that's a myth. I don't know. I had bought a camera and a light to do some freelance work because I was a freelance videographer as well. I did fundraising videos for nonprofits. And I just bought a camera and a light, and I was like, you know, I'd love to get into food photography. Let me see how well I can shoot something in my home kitchen. Let's see if I can get a good setup.
And right, like, so you could put it on your reel.
Yeah. And then I set it up, and I was like, this would make a pretty cool YouTube cooking show. There's nothing really out there quite like this. Everything else kind of looks like it's, you know, either shot in a studio or really shot in somebody's house. Like, there's no sort of in-between like this that kind of looks natural and whatever. And I had just happened to have seen an episode of Parks and Recreation where two of the titular characters, Ron Swanson and Chris Traeger, have a burger cook-off, see if Chris can make a turkey burger that tastes better than a beef burger. And I was so curious because Chris's burger was just this melange of bullshit foodie buzzwords. Like, can I swear? I don't know.
Yeah, okay. You can.
All right. It was just this
Taleggio. There was this.
Taleggio cheese crisp, right. Black truffle aioli, daikon microgreens, and just like, you know, and I was like, were the writers just having fun or would that actually taste good? And I was curious about it. And I never intended to make more than one episode of the show. I was just wanted to do an exercise. And that's why it has this name, Binging with Babish, because it was chosen utterly arbitrarily.
Right. So let's talk about that because I was so shocked. It was like when I found out about June, it was like, well, his name is Babish, right? No, his name's not Babish, you know, Kenji said, oh, his name is Andrew Ray. I was like, then why didn't he call his show Binging with Babish? So now there's the great reveal on the air. I know, but I want you to explain to our audience who Babish is.
Oliver Babish is a character from The West Wing. he was on maybe three episodes of The West Wing. I named my Reddit handle after him. And I wanted to just sort of make this video and share it on Reddit. So I just thought I'll make this, you know, work in concert with my Reddit account. And because at the time, Reddit Food is a very active community of food porn
right.
photos. And I was it had become an obsession of mine to try and make the front page of that subreddit as much as possible, like once a week. And I was totally addicted to that. So I was like, I'm going to take it one step further and make a show version of what I'm normally doing, which is just taking pictures and putting it on there. So I meant for it to just be a show for Reddit. And I always wonder, I can't imagine that Aaron Sorkin, when he was penning The West Wing, could have ever imagined that this super ancillary, ornery character portrayed by Oliver Platt would take on such a strange new life.
Yes.
Almost 10 years later.
It's true. That's so weird. And you didn't think like anyone, it would go beyond Reddit. It was just like something you wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it was just something just sort of the same way that I would expend a ton of energy just trying to make the best meatballs in the world that night. I wanted to make the best cooking show that I possibly could out of my apartment. Let me see what I can do. And then people liked it, got a few thousand views. People liked it enough that I felt encouraged to try it again. And I went all out and made timpano from Big
Night. Right, timpano from The Big Night. And that's a hilarious, particularly hilarious episode because your friends are there and you're talking about staying up all night and you know, I did get 3 hours of sleep. I'm feeling good, you know.
And I had the idea to make that episode the day that I made it. Like, that's just how my brain works. Like, I had the idea at 4 o'clock, and by 7 o'clock I was shooting. And and I was working a full-time job at the time. So I stayed up until 5 in the morning making Garganelli by hand. And then the next day I had all my friends over, and I was just out of my mind. I can tell you right now, we wouldn't be sitting here if that timpano leaked or exploded. I would have been like,
screw it, because you weren't going to do it again.
Yeah, it's time to find a new hobby. I don't need this stupid show. So I'm happy that that came out just right, because otherwise this would be a very different afternoon for me. I'd be at my job. Right,
so timpano, of course, is this incredibly elaborate. It's a festive dish.
Yes.
That's basically an encrusted pasta casserole, I would say.
Yes. It's called timpano because it kind of looks like a big old timpani drum. Like it's
right.
You make it either in a special timpano tub, or you make it in a big Dutch oven. So it ends up being, you know, a solid 8 inches tall and 12, 14 inches around. And you cut it open, and there's all these perfect layers of pasta and eggs and meatballs and sausage and cheese. Flavor and in form factor, it's not that different from a lasagna, but there's something special about it. It's
right.
Definitely like I said in the video, it's an event to cut one of those open.
Yeah, and they made in the movie, which I urge everyone to see if you've never seen The Big Night, which is an awesome movie. It's a big deal to make a timpano. Is not a casual endeavor.
Yeah, especially when one of the tenets of my show is to be as crazily accurate as possible. So I, you know, instead of buying boxed pasta, I saw that they were rolling the pasta by hand. So
I know. I was going to ask you about that. Like, why did you do that, dude? Are you making Garganelli by hand?
I promise you, anybody who is considering making timpano, please buy boxed pasta. Please. It's so not worth it. I'm here to determine whether or not these crazy things are worth it, and it is not. Just go buy some boxed pasta.
So when you were formulating the idea for Binging with Babbage, like, take us through briefly your thought process. Like, so I'm going to take a scene from a movie or a television show. Like, was it just a way to bring your two passions together?
Yeah, I mean, it was started off just being something very experimental and just for fun. Then as I decided, okay, I'm going to start pursuing this and making it, it became the subject of a lot of research and time, you know, watching movies, watching TV shows, trying to find, especially if something's topical, like, you know, Game of Thrones, I needed to find, okay, what can I accurately recreate from this show? And so I had to just go through message boards and comment threads and ask my subreddit and my viewers, like, what would you like to see from the show? So it's
so you made it interactive, and there's a deceptively casual quality, but there's actually what you're describing, there's nothing casual about it.
Not at all. No, I try to keep it light. I think the voiceover sort of brings an air of I do try to make it casual and make it personal try to just create a connection with the viewer by just being, you know, myself and not being too serious about it. But yeah, no, every episode takes a bare minimum of 30 hours, sometimes up to 60, 70.
Wow.
Depending on, you know, the complexity of what I'm doing. And also because I'm a one-man band, I shoot it myself, I edit it myself, I color correct, I do the voiceover all in my apartment, just me.
That's insane, dude. You are like Ken G.
That just gave me goosebumps.
Your video first,
yes,
he's cooking first.
Exactly. No, Kenji could cook circles around me, no problem. But that's very flattering to ever even be mentioned in the same breath as Kenji.
I'm thinking, okay, you have a job that's probably taking 50 hours, and then each episode is taking 30 hours.
Yeah.
And you're not making any money.
No.
So it doesn't seem like a successful business model in the making.
The people who know me know that I'm kind of impulsive and a risk taker when it comes to things that I really enjoy and things that I'm passionate about. And I felt something very fulfilling about making this show. This was really fulfilling to me, which is why, yeah, I didn't start monetizing the show until this past spring, when it became financially viable to do so. And at that point, I had been making the show for over a year without making a dime at that. And, you know, I had spent, I don't know, 10 grand on film equipment, and I have no idea how much on ingredients.
It was a money-losing proposition.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was an, I saw it as an investment. And just the growth is what kept me going. Back in November was when I sort of experienced my first growth spurt. I made a the Moist Maker from Friends, which is...
It's a hilarious episode.
It's
Moist Maker refers to the toast that's dipped in gravy that is the third piece of bread on the leftover Thanksgiving sandwich.
Yes. An amazing invention by Ross, not Ross Geller, but his sister, Monica. I don't know Friends well enough.
Right.
That was the first one that kind of caught some mainstream attention outside of Reddit. Actually, thanks to Reddit, because Reddit is kind of a trendsetter when it comes to videos. Anything that makes the top five might get mentioned by Huffington Post. And that's what happened. Entertainment Weekly talked about it, Food and Wine. And I realized, okay, I've got something here that people like and that has the potential to grow. Mm-hmm. So I committed to start making the show once a week. Before
right.
that, I had just
no
sort
matter
of done
if
it.
That caused you to get no sleep in that week.
Yep,
probably did guarantee that you got no sleep. And let's talk about Reddit and its role. And why don't you explain first of all why you were posting on Reddit, what Reddit is, and what role Reddit played in your success?
Well, Reddit is a content aggregator that uses a vote system. Basically, anybody can submit a picture or an article or a video to different subreddits. There's a videos subreddit. There's a pictures subreddit. There's a food subreddit. There's a subreddit for virtually any thing you can imagine. Name something there's going to be a subreddit for it. Horses, butterflies, and whatever. Anybody can post something, and then it is upvoted or downvoted by the community. And the more upvotes it gets, the more visible it gets because everything is ranked.
Got
essentially.
It.
If you get more upvotes, you get more and more exposure. And I became addicted to taking pictures of my dinner and stuff and putting it on the food subreddit. And I made number one a few times, and that was totally addicting. And Reddit became instrumental in my growth because they took a liking to me.
Well, and we should explain for people who are not familiar with Reddit, it's a messily democratic place.
It is a hive mind.
yeah, and... if you cross the Reddit community or they think that you've somehow sold them a bill of goods, they let you know.
Yes, they're a very honest community. They get tired of things pretty quickly, which is why I'm still amazed that they still like me. And it's funny that I'm referring to them as they because it's such an incredibly huge, diverse group
right.
of people. It's a very strange, beautiful part of the internet, and you can find some really incredible stuff there. You can find some very horrible things there.
Yeah, people get very nasty on Reddit.
Yeah.
Serious Eats was lauded and celebrated until it wasn't, and we still don't even know why.
Yeah, Reddit food has some very strict rules, and I don't know where they came from, and I haven't posted there in a long time as a result. In fact, I think I might be banned from that.
You're now banned?
I don't even know. The last time I posted, I remember it was invisible. So, yeah, I think I might be banned. But
the Reddit community really did play a role in growing your audience.
Absolutely. They you know, it was upvoted to the number one spot in Reddit videos, I think like 5 or 6 episodes were. And that's huge. There's a tremendous exposure whenever you reach number one. So that was utterly, totally vital in my growth as a channel.
And you grew so fast. I mean, you're at 1,500,000 subscribers. Not even 2 years now?
Not even 2 years. I started in February of last year, so just over a year and a bit.
That's crazy, and it's an internet success story. It sort of went against the grain for most hands-only food videos in that it was funny, it had a point of view, and in spite of how adept you are at visual effects, the script carries the story along much more than people think because the images are so compelling and you start with a fair use scene from the movie or television show. But in fact, it's your writing that, and maybe it's not written. I'd love to hear the process because that's your secret. You know, is that the writing is very personal. It's engaging. It's funny. It's smart. You're not trying to show everybody how hip you are or how high you are. It's, you know, which a lot of things on YouTube do.
That's one thing I found very important. Show when I mess up. Be self-deprecating because, I mean, that makes it a little more personal and also makes it more accessible for somebody who might not have ever tried cooking. Like, you know, if you see that I'm the cooking show host here and I'm making a mistake, or something explodes or I always love to show that because that's what cooking is. It's a learning process, and I'm learning as I make this show. Most of the things that you see me make on the show, I'm making for the first time.
Right. Have explosions actually taken place on the show?
The most recent one I can think of was when I was trying to pipe frosting onto the Curtisano Chocolat from Grand Budapest Hotel. So that was maybe like 5 episodes ago. And I had a frosting bag just the tip was too small and it just popped all over my arm. And it's like the little end card on the end of the episode. And I was sure to show that.
And it's important. I think that's part of why Kenji's stuff is so popular and Stella's and Daniel's on Series 8 is that we're not afraid to show that the process is not linear and it's messy.
Absolutely.
You thought that was an important component of what you were doing.
Very important. I think it makes it more accessible. And so many people have commented or gotten in touch with me somehow to say, like, I've tried making pasta aglio olio, which was one of my earlier episodes, very easy one to do. And I love cooking. It's gotten them into cooking. And I think it's in part because the show makes cooking look, even though I'm making some crazy stuff sometimes, I'm always unafraid to show that this is a learning process and this is not, you know, this isn't a polished Hollywood product. This
right.
is something
it's
that...
It's almost the un-Instagram...
Yes, exactly.
...moment or a series of un-Instagram moments.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that I've been working alone for so long is because when I started doing this, I was like, I want to make the cooking show that I would want to watch. And it's very... contrary to
yes,
how a lot of web
for
cooking
sure,
shows
For sure, it's contrary
function.
To a lot of YouTube cooking shows. There are now literally millions of hands-only recipe videos
yeah.
on the web.
Yeah. yeah. And thanks to BuzzFeed with the top down, like they invented something that really took off there. That's pretty incredible.
Right. Exactly. But your Binging with Babbage sort of flies in the face of all those conventions. It's really this wonderfully engaging point of view about food and life.
Thank you very much.
It's true.
And to answer your question, I have never written an episode. I basically – my post-production process is that I cut – and this is – any editor that hears this is going to roll their eyes in the back of their head because this is so not how you're supposed to do it. I edit to the music first. I don't like cut on every beat or anything like that, but I like for the edit to interact sort of – you know, you'll notice sometimes when I open up a cross section, it'll be at a swell in the music. And I edit to the music first, which is why sometimes my voiceover can be a little rushed because I'm trying to fit a lot of information I edited myself into a corner, which is why you're not supposed to do that. But I wanted there to be a lyrical cadence to mm-hmm. the show. I wanted there to be a definite pace.
Yes, there's a rhythm to each yeah. episode.
And then I pretty much just roll the mic as I'm watching it and just improv the voiceover. I have the recipe printed out in front of me so I can remember measurements and stuff. It's totally off the cuff, improvised VO. That's how I do it.
We're running out of time here. I know you have to run, but we haven't even gotten to how you came to make a dime from this obsession. Will you come back?
No, I'd absolutely love to come back. Yeah, totally.
Because you have really established a new financial model for independent creative types, and I want to talk to you about that. So anyway, Andrew, we'll see you again soon. So long, Serious Eaters, and we'll see all of you next time as well.